I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The history and psychology of leadership is explained in a highly readable, highly recommended book, Selected, Why Some People Lead, Why Others Follow, and Why It Matters. One of its authors joins me now, Mark Van Vogt, who joins me from Toronto now, co-wrote the book with Anjana Auja. What they've done here is take much scientific research, distilled it, added some fascinating anecdotes, and gives us, the reader, a great sweep through the last couple of million years to see who amongst us emerge as leaders, who are followers, and perhaps gives us a glimpse into where we're headed. Mark Van Vogt is a professor of psychology at the VU University of Amsterdam and holds honorary positions at the universities of Oxford and Kent. His website for more is at ProfessorMarkVanVogt.com. Selected is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Mark Van Vogt. Good morning, Professor Van Vogt.
Good afternoon, or good morning in Vancouver, I suppose.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Now, there's a great deal of scientific research in here. Is this a lot of your work?
Yes, and that of many others. I myself started working on leadership about, I suppose, 10, 15 years ago, and a summary of that is really in the book, and I've looked at many facets of leadership, usually through experiments, behavioral experiments with students, but what we try to do in this book is combine that research with anthropological research on leadership, neuroscience research, and also research that has been done by economists, for example, and political scientists.
Was there much research, say, 10 to 15 years ago on leadership, much work on it?
Yes. So leadership is probably one of the most studied topics in the social sciences. But we wrote the book partly because we were dissatisfied with the lack of sort of fundamental questions that were asked in the leadership literature. Now, a lot of the leadership literature is just hugely popular. Sort of the whole sort of management book range,
yeah.
But it basically deals with who is the leader and what great leaders are like, and it basically treats the topic as if leadership has been around only since the 18th century when these great leaders came to power. But so what we try to do in this book is to say, well, these are very fundamental questions. So why do we have leaders in the first place? And why are we so keen on following? What is the evolutionary history of leadership? And does it predate even human evolution? So we've taken a very long time perspective on the topic, which in our view was much needed.
And so when we go back these millions of years, have we always needed leaders? I mean, are we predisposed to needing leaders in our society?
Well, very much so. One of the sort of main lessons of our book is that you get leadership with all social animals, so animals that live in groups, because all group living animals need to solve coordination problems. It could be how to find food resources as a group, or moving from as a group from one place to the other, or internal peacekeeping. All these sorts of functions have been performed by leaders in many different species. And, I mean, human evolution obviously has its own characteristics, and that has also changed leadership a little bit. But you get basically leaders in all species that have to solve these coordination problems.
And is that the preserve of a few, leadership? I mean, are most of us then just followers?
Well, certainly in animals that live in large groups, such as humans, we at some point during our human evolution felt that there was a need to sort of institutionalize leaders, but that is something of a very recent modern history. What you see in other animals, and we've done a review of the literature, is, for example, in guppies, those little fish,
mm-hmm.
it is the the ones with a bold personality that are most likely to take the lead, whereas those with a more shy personality sit back and wait for leaders to take the initiative. So personality, motivation, but also knowledge. For example, in the elephants, it's the matriarch who has the greatest knowledge of long-forgotten waterholes on the savannah, for example, who takes the lead.
Now, you and I are human, so I'm interested in sort of the human element, the aspect of leadership. A couple of things that stood out in reading the book, women leaders. They've attracted a great deal of hostility, politically and in business and the sort.
Yes.
What's the reason for that? What have you found in your research that explains that sort of attitude that women encounter?
Well, what we argue is that in our ancestral environment as hunter-gatherers, we had many different leadership functions to perform. But one important one was to protect the group from predators or from other groups, and that selected for a more masculine leader type, a physically formidable individual. And we take those prototypes, they're sort of hardwired in our brain, we take them when we make judgments about the suitability of leaders nowadays. And so when people are working in a very competitive business environment, for example, that elicits a more masculine leader prototype, and that often works at the disadvantage of women.
And is there something that happens physically in the brain that makes us think that way?
I'm not sure how. Obviously, every evolved trait or perception does have a sort of a residual in the brain, but we're not at the point yet that we are able to pinpoint leadership or followership in particular areas of the brain. But definitely what we argue is that we are judging individuals in terms of their suitability for leadership based on these evolved innate decision rules that come at a very early age, we believe, in our childhood, and will operate when we make decisions as who we select as political candidates, who we follow in many domains of life.
I'm jumping here because there's so many things to cover in the time that we have. You'll forgive me. But just on that point of the neuroscience that you've looked at in your research, well, has the brain itself, the brain has obviously developed over the millions of years.
Yes.
What does the neuroscience that you looked at tell us about leaders and the sort of leaders that we have, or that emerge, I should say?
Well, one of the things that is in the book is some evidence from these eye gaze experiments. They're experiments that cognitive psychologists do. Basically, they show a face on the computer screen, and the eye gaze of the face changes. And so the question is, who does the participant follow? And so what we found, for example, is that a more dominant-looking face, when the eye gaze of that individual moves from one direction to the other, they're more likely to attract followers. And so that is a piece where we think, maybe we do have these preconceived notions about which individuals are more likely to become leaders.
What explains the phenomena of the attraction to taller leaders?
Our hypothesis is that it is, again, based on the savanna environment in which our brains evolved. We lived for 99% of human evolution in small hunter-gatherer bands on the savanna in Africa. That is a fact. And so our brains are adapted to that particular situation. And with regard to leadership, one of the biggest threats to the group was attacks from other groups or from predators. And so an individual who was tall and physically formidable would serve the function of being the protective leader, or the warrior leader, as we call them. That is one hypothesis. The other is that height, particularly in ancestral environments, may have been a good indicator of health and genetic fitness. And these are qualities that we find important in who we decide to follow.
And I'm thinking of two leaders in particular, Sarkozy in France and Berlusconi in Italy, who are not known to be tall.
And yes, I mean, our theory obviously doesn't explain with 100% accuracy who will emerge as leader in any particular context.
But it's fascinating to think, Professor, how that they are attuned to that, that it's a concern for them, their lack of height.
Yes, I do believe that is true. And so, for example, in the book we cite the anecdotes of both Sarkozy and Berlusconi. Berlusconi, for example, whenever he gives a speech, he usually stands on a platform to elevate him and to make sure that his shortness, if you like, is not seen as a handicap. Sarkozy, for example, is known to wear high heels. Well, not high heels as in Carlo Bruni's or Carla Bruni's shoes, but heels with platforms, at least. So they probably are aware at perhaps a very subconscious level of the disadvantage that the height might give them in contests or encounters with other foreign leaders.
The idea of language is particularly fascinating in this book, as to the development of, say, language and rhetoric, and how that has, I guess, that's gone hand in hand with the attitude toward leadership, right?
Yes, but I mean, the story is a bit more complicated because we argue that, given that our brains evolved for the most part at times when there was no language, because language only really evolved 50,000 years ago, and we're going back as a species probably about 2.5 million years ago. So many of the judgments we make as regard to who is suitable as leader, we base upon things that have nothing to do with language at all, based on physique, based on posturing, based on the face, etc. So that's very relevant information. However, in recent evolutionary history, what you see is that there was a pressure for humans to form ever larger groups, and these need to be coordinated, and language obviously was a good means to coordinating large groups. And what you see then is the emergence of leaders who use language as a device to bond large groups of individuals together, often through releasing very positive emotions through crowds. And the charismatic leader is one prototype of that, who often uses language and rhetoric to attract a whole group of people to them and raising positive emotions in them.
The you had a piece in the Globe and Mail this past weekend giving 7 tips on how to, if you're a dictator,
tongue-in-cheek, though.
Yeah, correct. How to cultivate that power. And the failure of leadership is something that we're familiar with, say, with the recession. Mm. And these dictators that have fallen and lost several weeks. The idea of corruption and leadership, has that been around forever?
Well, it is in our nature. I mean, we are humans. We are branch of the family of primates, and primates often engage in these dominance battles, dominance hierarchies, and so what that has given us is a sort of innate drive to get status and get power, and power obviously, as in chimpanzees and in gorillas, gives you access to resources, to mates, and is a good opportunity to increase your reproductive success. So when humans get into positions of power, they like it, they thrive in it, they are very happy, they have all kinds of positive emotions with it. The problem is that they want to accumulate more and more power. They are addicted to it, and they often then use it. If followers can't organize themselves, they often use it to their own advantage, or the advantage of their family.
And the idea of democracy, that's a pretty new concept, I guess, in the history of human evolution. How have we?
Well, I don't think so.
I
would disagree with that. Because,
okay.
We have to go back to our egalitarian hunter-gatherers for evidence of democracy, and democracy is much older than Athens or Rome. It probably really started on the savannah, where you have these fiercely egalitarian groups of hunter-gatherers who were very, very keen on maintaining their autonomy and individual freedom. And if they didn't like it, they just went away or disposed of their leader. And so democracy, as in other animals, is very innate to humans. It's just that sometimes, in some situations, and particularly sort of recent times, medieval times, etc., you get these leaders, these individuals who accumulate more and more power and start using that to dominate their followers. But that, I think, is really very much at odds with human nature, because I would argue that we are really very democratic apes.
And taking it to, say, the level that most people listening perhaps are more familiar with, working in companies, does your research suggest where we're happiest, say in a small company or a large corporation, or what are we more familiar with, say?
Well, what we argue, and there is a little bit of evidence for that as well that we cite, is that people are happiest working in organizations or units of organizations that resemble these simple band structures. So you have about 100 and 150 individuals which you can organize through informal social controls. You know more or less everyone by their names, and that creates a sort of intimate atmosphere in which there is trust and some emotional synchrony, so you all sort of feel and think alike, and you have some sort of shared identity. Now, organizations, if they grow much larger than 100, 150 individuals, will still have to find ways to maintain that intimate atmosphere, where the leader or the manager indeed can exercise influence through persuasion and through informal, individualized relationships with their subordinates. And some organizations do better in that than others.
And middle managers, we seem to hate them, don't we?
Well, our brains are not have not evolved with the middle manager. It was really for 99% of our history, it was inconceivable that somebody would tell us what to do on behalf of somebody else up higher in the hierarchy. That concept simply didn't exist, and so when we interact with middle managers and they tell us what to do, we get really very pissed off because we don't really separate the role that they occupy from the person that they are.
And do you think there has to be some change in the way that, say, business is structured, government is structured, so that we get the best leaders we possibly can, or leaders that aren't dictators or that aren't corrupt, say?
Yes, well, I'm not really in a position to claim that everything we do is, or organizations do, or businesses do is bad. I'm only here to argue that if we want organizations to grow larger, we should find ways to make sure that at all levels of an organization, people have some sort of almost individualized relationship with their leader, the man or woman on the top of the organization. If you want to turn subordinates into a group of followers who are really voluntarily motivated to follow this particular CEO or company or president, that leader will have to find ways, and perhaps through new social media or something like that, to really relate to his or her followers. And so I think that is really important. The other aspect I think is really important is that followers or subordinates are allowed to use what we call stops, strategies to make sure that the leaders don't become too powerful in order to restrain the power of those leaders. And that can be done via networking, it can be done via public appeals, whistleblowers, all sorts of ways to organize themselves as followers.
Professor Van Vogt, it's been a fascinating conversation. I'm really enjoying the book. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Well, thanks for your compliments. I really appreciate that.
The website for more, ProfessorMarkVanVogt.com, that's all one word. The book is called Selected, Why Some People Lead, Why Others Follow, and Why It Matters. It's published by Random House. It was co-written with Anjana Oja. Mark Van Vogt on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.